Hello there. Today is Tuesday, February 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president says the U.S. is open to talks with North Korea under the right conditions.
You know, they've been talking for 25 years. Other presidents should have solved this problem long before I got here.
The gun debate rages on with no sign of agreement on a solution. 5 months after Hurricane Maria struck, thousands in Puerto Rico still without power. Also ahead, the World Cup arrives in Kenya. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, as the debate over guns in the United States rages on following the Valentine's Day school shooting that killed 17 people, First Lady Melania Trump made a rare public remarks to the spouses of U.S. governors during a White House luncheon Monday.
As a parent, I cannot imagine the kind of grief and tragedy like that brings. And I hope and I know we all find ourselves wondering what we can do to help. In my year as First Lady, I have also learned that it's often times after a tragedy that you see the strength and resilience of the human spirit. I have been heartened to see children across this country using their voices to speak out and try to create change. They're our future, and they deserve a voice.
President Trump held a White House meeting with governors Monday to talk about ways to prevent another school massacre and said he'll sign an order banning the sale of bump stocks. The gunman who killed more than 50 people in Las Vegas in October used the device called bump stocks that let his semi-automatic guns fire more bullets in a shorter amount of time. 2 weeks after the former student returned to his Parkland, Florida high school and stands accused of killing 17 people, the president said a school that is a gun-free zone is an invitation for very sick people.
We have to take steps to harden our schools so that they're less vulnerable to attack. This includes allowing well-trained and certified school personnel to carry concealed firearms. At some point, you need volume. I don't know that a school is going to be able to hire 100 security guards that are armed.
Well, it doesn't seem to be an idea that Florida Governor Rick Scott, a Trump ally and fellow Republican, agrees with.
I want our teachers to teach, and I want our law enforcement officers to be able to protect the students. I want each group to focus on what they're good at.
Joining us now to discuss is criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice. So what do you think of the idea the president's proposing about arming teachers?
I'm really concerned about this. I mean, as a former CIA officer, I was trained and really became good at just about every weapon known to man. I spent a lot of time on it, and I was good at it. I mean, that's a big part of this. And the training that I had was so much more extensive than I typically see, not just with those who have concealed carry permits, but I'm talking about police officers as well, and a lot more than those people, including people in the military. My concern is that the kind of training we're talking about is absolutely insufficient. Contemplate what it would be like putting somebody who has minimal training in a firefight surrounded by 3,000 kids. That's the most horrifying idea I can possibly imagine.
What would concern you the most about it?
The biggest problem is you don't have sufficient training and capability. Mm-hmm. I mean, the real issue is this may be the most dangerous environment there is. There are children literally everywhere. If you miss by an inch, you hit three. And that's a perfect example. If you have two people with weapons mm-hmm. or more, the problem is the likelihood is you're actually going to see more deaths.
Right.
More carnage, more violence you would see if you had only one.
A shootout in the school.
Well, exactly. And you think about what that potentially means, especially when you have somebody who has minimal training and you have somebody even worse who has minimal training and a Rambo-esque approach. That is the worst combination there is.
People I know around the world are wondering why this is such an issue in the United States. We don't see these kinds of shootings in other places, but we've also got a Second Amendment that protects an American's right to bear arms.
As a CIA officer, I recognize that there is a need for weapons under very specific circumstances, and that issue absolutely exists. And there is a Second Amendment requirement for it. And as a former prosecutor and as a defense attorney, I also understand the need to abide by the Constitution. That is critically important. But the idea that it's somehow the Second Amendment is simply unlimited is inconsistent with what I have seen on the First Amendment, because there are limitations, on the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment. There are limitations there. So to somehow assume that the Second Amendment is without limitation, mm-hmm. without exclusion, simply inconsistent with how you define the Constitution. So I think it's important that we're consistent with how we approach this and realize that the NRA is not the arbiter of what the Constitution says.
What are you referring to? Are you referring to the use of assault weapons in the hands of pretty much anybody that wants one?
Well, absolutely. There should be limitations because, let's be clear, an AR-15, an M-16, and an M-4, this is a weapon that was very specifically designed to be in a war zone setting to kill as many human beings as possible. I mean, that's what it's designed to do. And I can tell you without question that if the real issue here is hunting, you do not use an M4, an M16, an AR-15. You don't. If this is about protecting your own home, and I can talk about how I would use this in a close contact question, you would never use an M16, an M4, an AR-15. You just wouldn't. This would be the last weapon you would ever choose under these circumstances. So to argue that these are the weapons that you need to defend yourself under these circumstances is simply not true. This is coming from somebody who knows.
What about the sheriff deputy that apparently stood outside and did not go in to try to take down the shooter or address the situation?
It's an issue I've been thinking about a lot because we've all thought about this, the idea that this young man potentially went in and killed this number of people, these number of children, in some 6 minutes. What do you do if you're actually armed and you're outside of a building? Do you simply storm the building by yourself and just start firing? Where do you go? Who do you go after? How do you prepare for this? What happens if you go in blind? What happens if you hit somebody else? These are all questions that are legitimate questions and ones that I think are important because let's contemplate. If you were the first police officer who had just arrived on the scene and you heard that something was going on inside, but you don't know what, you don't know where, you don't know how many, you don't know how many people are dead, you don't know how many hostages there are. The idea that you would do some strange John Wayne approach where you drive through the front door, firing and asking questions later, that simply is inconsistent with every police approach and, frankly, every SWAT team approach and every JSOC approach and every other military approach that you would ever use under these circumstances. I think to blame this man at this point is premature at best. It may be unrealistic under those circumstances, too.
All right, criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Congress returns with gun violence, an unexpected issue. Tunisia and Spain vow cooperation on security and women's rights. The U.S. Supreme Court declines to enter the Dreamers controversy just yet. And the European Union and Arab League affirm Jerusalem must be a joint capital. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump is expressing a willingness to talk with North Korea, but only under the right conditions. Speaking Monday to state governors at the White House, Trump noted North Korea's offer in recent days, relayed through South Korea's president, that they want to talk to the United States. At Monday's briefing, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the U.S. will continue to put maximum pressure on the regime.
We also believe that there is a brighter path available to North Korea. They have expressed a desire to hold talks, but let us be completely clear. Denuclearization must be the result of any dialogue with North Korea.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies with the Center for National Interest, what it means the president's willing to engage with North Korea under the right conditions.
What that means is that the Trump administration, I think, has been signaling for a little while now that the only way that they're going to negotiate with North Korea is if the North Koreans are serious about denuclearization. There's been quite a few comments from Mike Pence and others that they're willing as an initial step to talk to the North Koreans, but that they're not going to give anything up for just the simple pleasure of talking with them. They want to move very quickly from, you know, talks and getting to know one another to negotiations over their nuclear program. I've heard from many White House officials at this point over the last week, week and a half or so, that they're willing to talk to the North Koreans, but if the talks don't move quickly to some sort of talk about denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, they will walk away from those talks.
Mr. Trump, in speaking to the governors, praised China's President Xi Jinping for bolstering his country's sanctions against the North, but warned that Russia is, quote, behaving badly on the issue. Quote, Russia is sending in what China is taking out. What's going on there?
Well, the Russians have been caught on a few occasions now doing what are called ship-to-ship transfers of what we think is oil. There have been pictures that have been circulating on the Internet, quite a few open-source reports. That actually goes back to late December.
The North Korean delegation during the closing ceremonies of the Winter Olympics in South Korea, led by Kim Jong-chol, a controversial figure, without a doubt, indicated that the North twice would be willing to engage in dialogue with the U.S. Knowing the U.S. position, why would they advance that?
Well, there's a few theories that have been postulated. I think the one that makes the most sense is this is right out of the North Korean playbook. It's a play for time. We have to remember the North Koreans have not tested an ICBM or a long-range missile since November. I would theorize that the North Koreans are probably pulling together all the data of the two other ICBM tests they did in July, and they're trying to solve one big problem. How do you get those North Korean missiles to basically go through the atmosphere and hit a target? That's the last part that they need to be able to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon. So I think they're using this Olympic detente, if you will, to get to that last part of the puzzle. And I think it gives them, you know, a little bit of opportunity to string some of these talks along. But I don't think the Trump administration is going to fall into that trap. So I think North Korea is going to get in trouble for doing that if they choose to do so.
Well, right in the middle of these two positions, you have South Korea's President Moon Jae-in, who met with North Korean delegations twice during the Olympic Games, and after the most recent one, came away saying that the U.S. needs to lower the threshold in order for it to meet with North Korea, while at the same time the North has to take steps toward denuclearization. Are those two positions possible?
In some respects, yes. I think that what the South is trying to do more than anything else, they want to keep these talks going. They want to lower the pressure and the tensions on the Korean Peninsula. So I think what Seoul is trying to do is trying to create an environment where Pyongyang and Washington can talk, maybe build some ties, build some mutual good trust. Because I think we all know you're just not going to jump into a negotiation where North Korea willingly gives up its nuclear weapons or would be willing to give up its nuclear weapons even at a high price. So Seoul, I think, is trying to sort of bridge the gap between these two situations. But I think that where we're heading in the next few weeks is key. We're going to have the Paralympics happening in South Korea. That buys us about three and a half weeks before the United States and South Korea announce the dates and the scale of the full Eagle military exercises. Those exercises have 300,000 plus troops, and traditionally North Korea gets very upset when we do those exercises. So the question happens, if those exercises go forward, which I think I have every reason to believe that they will North Korea react by firing off missiles again? That's what we're going to have to see.
Harry, on Friday, Washington announced its largest package of sanctions yet on North Korea. The president warned of a phase two that could be, quote, very, very unfortunate for the world if the steps did not work. What do you think he means?
Well, I think there's only two things that can mean. If you take it to the extreme, that means war. And I don't think that means a bloody nose, because I think anybody who just looks at the military situation on the ground, you're not going to launch a simple strike like we did against Bashar Assad that had no impact. You're going to go into North Korea, you're going to go in to break their spine. You're going to launch an all-out attack to try and destroy their nuclear program. But thankfully, I don't think that that's what phase two means. I think what phase two would mean would be sanctions on steroids. You'd be talking about potentially a naval blockade. You would see Nikki Haley go to the UN and try to get all, you know, a massive oil embargo, something that China would have to enforce. You would see basically the United States try to cut North Korea off the global map. I think that's what the United States would do short of war.
That's Harry Kasianis, a director of defense studies with the Center for National Interest. Well, as Europe seeks to stop migrants and militants reaching its shores, EU's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said on Friday that international donors have raised more than $500 million for a multinational military force in West Africa Sahel region, VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The European Union's top diplomat says the $510 million amount pledged at the international conference has exceeded their expectations.
It goes beyond initial expectations, thanks to an enormous mobilization, not only of the European Union and its member states, but also of other international partners.
Evoking the desperation young people feel in the impoverished Sahel, Niger's president said many of the youth had just two options in life.
One is to die at sea rather than dying in front of their mother, like what was said by a young migrant. Or the other choice, to respond to the malicious and manipulative call of terrorist groups in direct connection with criminal activities, weapons trafficking, and drugs.
To give hope to the next generation, Luxembourg's prime minister insists on the need to help the Sahel countries.
I think we should never forget that Sahel is not that far away. And it's in our interest also that we avoid conflict situation. I was a few weeks ago with my Belgian colleague, also a Dutch colleague in Mali. And we should see that the situation is, for the moment, a very difficult situation.
For the African Union Commission president, it's crucial to remember that no international action, no matter how strong it is, can substitute the efforts of the countries of the region.
By organizing via the G5 a global vision to respond to the multidimensional challenges that this group's countries are faced with, we will have accomplished a useful work in the fight against terrorism. The political will and firm commitment of this region constitutes the walls of this fight.
And while the summit was a real success, it's important to plan ahead, said Niger's president.
Unfortunately, the resources announced cover costs only for the first year of operations of the G5 Sahel joint forces. It's not certain that confrontations between us and the terrorists end in a year.
The G5 Sahel group was set up by Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, and plans to coordinate with the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali and France's anti-insurgent operation Barkhane, whose troops were deployed in the region since intervening in 2013 to beat back an insurgency in northern Mali. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it's an issue that's been out of the news for a while, but residents of the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico are continuing to struggle 5 months after the devastating damage from Hurricane Maria. The Child Welfare Agency New York Foundling continues to have staff on the ground and is assisting residents in a number of ways to rebuild their homes and lives. Joining us now is Foundling President and CEO Bill Baglini. Thank you so much for being with us. So what can you tell us about the state of things on the island?
we still have about a third of our staff and families without electricity and about 5% without water. So this is after more than 5 months in. So it's quite difficult. We have conference calls every day with them. We go down a lot. It's a very compromised place, but our contractual obligations are to provide care to 1,500 kids and families through Head Start. And we're very proud of the fact that we're actually serving just about 90% of them now. While all of our sites have not opened yet, the fact of the matter is, for those kids, we're doing home-based services in their homes. We have given straight-out grants to all of our staff who will never return to their homes. So that's grants for them to just get themselves back on their feet. Then, for all of our 450 staff on the island, we have offered them interest-free loans with no prepayment required for 6 months, and then it stretches out for 3 years. So if we can't get them back on our feet, there's no way they're going to be able to provide the kind of care we know those people on the island require and deserve.
What kind of specific needs are there currently for the folks on the ground there as far as residents?
Because we deal in a lot of the most impoverished areas and some of the rural areas, we're still shipping water. We're still providing meals that we, you know, in normal times wouldn't provide to these kids and families. So we've become kind of the center for some of these local villages because we've gotten, you know, we've gotten our sites back open. Because we've been on the island for 35 years, we kind of have some relationships with contractors and builders. So we worked very, very hard to get our sites open as soon as we could. So, but it's expensive,
right?
And it's we have to spend money that government doesn't reimburse us for. But we view them as the sixth borough of New York City. We love those beautiful people, and we are going to stay there. We're going to stay through it with them, and we're going to get everybody back on their feet.
What's the power situation there? Is there still an issue with people having power? Obviously, it sounds like there's still an issue with food and water.
Oh, no, there's still power situation. I would say it's about 30%, Lori, of both our staff and the families they serve are still without power. And again,
wow.
This is five and a half months in, and we still have 5 to 7% without running water. In fact, to put it in perspective, the woman who runs our finances on the island, she has been without power since Irma, which occurred, I think, 3 or 4 weeks before Maria. So it's still a very, very challenging environment. But we're not going anywhere, and we're there for the long run.
What are some of the staff saying about the folks that are still on the ground that chose to stay and not leave after all this disaster?
You raise an interesting point about leaving. We have lost about 10% of the families that we serve because, think about, a young mother is confronted with a decision, do I stay or do I leave and get my child back in school? We have schools that many of the schools still haven't opened yet. So these young mothers are forced with, think about that decision. You have to leave your homeland in order to do what's right as a parent. The other, I think, the most poignant story that tears at your heart is we know that we try to keep the kids as long as we can each day because we know the meal that we feed them may be the last meal that they get before we see them again the next morning. And in fact, to hear kids come in and tell a teacher that they hadn't eaten since their mid-afternoon meal with us, you know, it's tough. It's very, very tough. And it's we are very, very concerned. And I know, you know, some of the folks don't want to hear about this. And I'm not a psychologist, nor do I have a clinical orientation. But there's every reason to be concerned about the impact of chronic trauma. This is now 5.5 months in, and trees are still run all over the place. Wires are still down. So we're going to have to deal, I think, for some time to come with the results or the consequences of the chronic trauma that these kids and families have been exposed to.
All right. Well, we appreciate your giving us an insight into what's going on there. Foundling President and CEO Bill Bacchiglini. The FIFA World Cup trophy has arrived in Kenya. A tour that began last September will see the famed trophy make stops in more than 50 countries across 6 continents ahead of its ultimate destination, Russia, the host of this year's World Cup tournament. Rael Ambour reports from Nairobi.
There was excitement as the most coveted trophy in football, the FIFA World Cup trophy, landed in Kenya's capital for a 26-hour visit on Monday. Kenya is one of 10 African countries where FIFA, soccer's top organizing body, is bringing the trophy on its 51-country global tour. The trophy and its handlers were met in Nairobi by government officials, FIFA country officials, and the country manager for Coca-Cola, which is sponsoring the tour. FIFA marketing manager Lucas Rasco is part of the team taking the trophy to various African countries.
As you know, there have been a lot of African teams participating at the FIFA World Cup. And for us, it is a great pleasure to be in Africa. I know there are a lot of passionate football fans here. And for us, it is about inspiring the youth and the football players of the country of, you know, maybe dreaming of one day winning the FIFA World Cup.
The trophy also visited Kenya before World Cup tournaments in 2010 and 2014. Football fans in Kenya will have a chance to view and take photos of the trophy on Tuesday at the Kenyatta International Convention Center in Nairobi. The trophy stands only 36 centimeters tall and weighs just 6 kilograms, but it is extremely valuable, partly because it is made out of 18-karat gold, partly because it represents the pinnacle of soccer achievement around the world. The trophy can only be touched and held by a very select group of people that include former World Cup winners and heads of state. President Uhuru Kenyatta held the trophy at State House a couple of hours after its arrival. Kenya will not make it to the tournament in Russia as it lost to Cape Verde at the pre-qualifier stage in 2015. African countries that qualified for the tournament and a chance to win the trophy are Morocco, Nigeria, Egypt, Senegal and Tunisia. On Tuesday, the trophy and its handlers take off again, heading to Maputo, Mozambique. Rael Ombor, VOA News, Nairobi.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But find us anytime at all at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, has designated longtime Colombian criminal Javier García Rojas, also known as Maracuya, and two other Colombian nationals as specially designated narcotics traffickers, or SDNTs, pursuant to the Foreign Narcotics Kingpin Designation Act, for their links to previously designated SDNTs José Byron Piedrahita Ceballos and the Colombian criminal group La Oficina de Envigado. The OFAC designation, announced on February 14th, also included four Colombian companies owned, controlled, or directed by the designated individuals. As a result of this action, U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions or otherwise dealing with these individuals and companies, and any assets they may have under U.S. jurisdiction are blocked. The four companies designated by OFAC include two Medellin, Colombia-based agricultural businesses owned by Javier García Rojas, Agro Construcciones Las Palmeras, and MMAG, Agricultural Global, as well as an investment company controlled by Ruth García Rojas called Pinzon and García, based in the city of Cali, Colombia. Also designated is a small automotive repair business in Medellin, Colombia, called Euromecanica, owned by Wilton Cesar Hernandez Durango. Since June 2000, more than 2,000 individuals and entities have been named pursuant to the Kingpin Act for their role in international narcotics trafficking. Penalties for violations of the Kingpin Act range from civil penalties of up to $1,437,153 per violation to more severe criminal penalties. Criminal penalties for corporate officers may include up to 30 years in prison and fines up to $5 million. Other individuals could face up to 10 years in prison and fines pursuant to Title 18 of the United States Code for Criminal Violations of the Kingpin Act. Treasury is targeting Colombian nationals, including Javier García Rojas, under the Kingpin Act for their attempts to undermine joint U.S.-Colombian investigations into the criminal activities of La Oficina and José Byron Piedrahita Ceballos, said Siegel Mandelker, Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. We are intent on disrupting the narcotics trafficking and illicit activities of organized crime groups like La Oficina, and work closely with our partners in the DEA, FBI, and U.S. Customs and Border Enforcement to dismantle their corrupt networks.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.